Thanks everyone for coming. So I will be introducing a new framework that we have for resource theories, but first I'll spend some time motivating and giving some examples of resource theories. Okay, so let's start with some questions. What do entanglement theory, thermodynamics, Minecraft, quantum computation, and chess have in common? And it's not what you're thinking. So I'd argue that it can all be seen as some game that some agent is playing, okay? It's trying to achieve something, be it like performing QKD or extracting work from some thermal system or, you know, building a roller coaster in Minecraft or win a game of chess. He's always trying to implement something and is subject to some constraints, some physical constraints or some rules or some technical constraints, okay? And resource theories are just a framework in which to study these kind of problems, which are very, very general. So, for example, it should be very more familiar maybe to most of you if you look at the example of non-locality. So the idea here is that, well, entanglement is useful. We can do KKD with it. We can do teleportation. Very cool resource. The problem is that, well, we cannot really distribute it over long distances without losses at the moment. Okay? And in order for it to have all these nice features, then we would require it to be, say, no signaling, so really long distances, so we can't do this. So then, what are the easy operations? We could say, well, let's say local operations and classical communication. And this is already being very generous. And so what we can study within this framework is like how to convert quantum states to different quantum states. So imagine you have a bipartition between Alice and Bob, AB, and your set of resources are just quantum states. Yep. So what do we learn from here? The first thing, obviously, is that the set of operations imposes some order in the set of states. Like not all states are created equals. There is some pre-order here, which means I can obtain sigma from rho using some operation in LCC. And there's this idea of free resources. I know this looks very big, but it just means that it's a resource that can always be achieved within an LCC, even if you don't know the initial state. So even if I don't know the initial state, I can use local operations to prepare a new state here and prepare a new state there and correlate them classically. So all separable states are free resources. Then in the case of bipartite entanglement, there's this nice notion of a currency. What is a currency? So this is some resource that if you have many copies of it, you can build any other state. Okay? So in the case of LCC, you could take, for instance, a Bell pair as a currency. And if you're trying to find monotones in your resource theory, like conditions to tell you when a state can be transformed into a different state, then these kind of things, currencies are very useful. Because then you can write, say, the cost of some resource in terms of this currency. So it's like the minimum number of coins, in this case of Bell pairs, that you need to use in order to achieve, to create this state. Okay? And this corresponds more or less to the entanglement of formation. The same notion. And you can also ask, oh, what is the yield of some resource? So if I have this resource, then how many of these coins can I achieve, can I reach? Okay? And this corresponds to this idea of distillation entanglement. By the way, if you have questions at any point, interrupt me. So, and then you can use these two things to create sufficient and necessary conditions for state transformation, right? So for instance, if the yield of a resource rho is larger than the cost of a different resource, then you can obviously do this transformation because you start with rho, you create yield rho coins, and then use part of these coins to create sigma. And similarly, if rho can be transformed into sigma, then it better be that the cost of rho is larger than the yield of sigma, because if not, we can create infinite money with this. So, right, so we start with rho, we transform it into sigma, transform it into these coins you can buy with sigma, and then use part of these coins to obtain rho again. So we have like a cyclic process, but now we have some extra coins, some extra resources for free. Okay? So this corresponds actually to a kind of second law. It's the idea that you cannot create money for free. Okay. And then you can study many more things, right? So you can study optical asymptotic conversion rates and use this to study monotones and try to find resource inequalities between e-bits and quantum channels, etc. And also study, say, catalysts and things. And something else is approximate transformations. So this is a very operational concept, which comes from the fact that, well, maybe you cannot guarantee that you create this state row exactly, or it would be very, very expensive. But maybe you can create some state row prime that is very close to row, okay? And then this, the cost might lower. Okay. Another very different example, but that has all the same concepts, is thermodynamics. So there, you have an agent that is trying to exploit nature. So for instance, we say that we have all these thermal states for free. We have some environment at some temperature, and this is free. And then I try to build some steam engines or some fridges or whatever. And my limitations could be, say, lack of knowledge about the state of a system. So for instance, I only know PVT, some microscopic observables. And of course, some conservation laws, like I have to conserve energy and I have to conserve angular momentum, etc. So then you can use this idea, the spirit of these limitations, to try to create resource theories. So from adiabatic operations or thermal operations at the macroscopic level to quantum thermal operations. So for instance, in this case, it means that we're allowed to apply any unitary that preserves energy, and you're allowed to bring in any system in a Gibbs state. So there, your resources then become, it's a system that is in a quantum state and has some Hamiltonian. Okay. And using actually very similar concepts to the ones before, like the idea of a currency, then if you have a pure qubit in an excited state, you can use this as a currency to create any state. And using these kind of things, then you get insights like Landauer's principle that tells you what is the work cost of information, or the work value of information, how much work does it cost to create one bit of information. And we get a set of free energy as monotones. Then you can use the idea of approximations, which is very natural in this context where we don't have exact control, to derive some operational smooth entropies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So these are just two examples that show you how you can see a very practical problem, but also very foundational problems as resource theories. And so they all have this, at least in quantum theory, they all have these elements in common, so allowed operations, a preorder, a set of free states, which is what comes for free, like thermal states, monotones that you can find, and sometimes you have like a scalable currency. By the way, here C0s is for the case where you want to implement some quantum computation, and you ask, okay, how many C0s do I need to implement this, assuming that, say, single qubit operations are for free. And so there have been some results in trying to find a generalized framework for this. So here, Tobias has two in category theory, which are very, very general. And also, Fernando Brandão has this paper on quantum resource theories in which they derive that the distance to the set of free states is always a monotone, for instance. Okay. So one thing that these works have in common, and this other resource theories that I mentioned, one thing they have in common is that they always assume that you can compose resources. Okay, it's like I have one qubit and I have another qubit and I can bring them together. And we'll talk a bit about this in a moment. So I'm more interested in creating a general framework in which I can relate and combine the views of different agents. So this could be agents that have different restrictions on the operations, say someone only has LO and someone has LOCC, or someone who is trying to combine the restrictions of thermal operations and LOCC, for instance. But it could also be two agents that have different levels of knowledge. So say, for instance, someone who has only access to macroscopic degrees of freedom, thermodynamics, and then someone else who has access to the actual quantum state. So how can I relate the microscopic thermodynamics that we're doing to the standard one? There should be like a map between the two. And also a combination of the two. So you could think that you have a global agent that has access to a big set of operations and knows the global state, and a local agent that only has access to a restricted set and only knows the local state. Or two local agents like Alice and Bob that could be cooperating or not. Okay, so I want this to be very global, very general, and I want to be able to apply this to, say, cryptography as well. So the other thing is about the subsystems and composability of resources. The resource theories that we saw and the approach there in general is this bottom-up approach. So say I have some building blocks and I can compose them, which makes sense from an engineer point of view. Okay, but now imagine that you're a physicist and you're looking at the world and you're asking, like, how can I find structure in here? How can I find subsystems here? Okay. This is my top-down approach. And I want to, also because I want to relate the knowledge of, say, a local observer to a global one, I want to be able to find a subsystem structure from the global state, from the global space. And the idea here will be to use modularity of transformations. So how do I, where do I call, I don't know, a qubit a subsystem and a different qubit a different subsystem? This is because I have some set of operations that I can apply here that don't affect what I do there, and vice versa. So I will use these notions to define subsystems. And something else is that it should also, the idea of approximations and robustness and approximation stability of a theory should be very natural. I should not need to do some extra minimizations. There should be a way to represent a state of knowledge that is like some epsilon ball of some state. Okay. Yes, so now I will introduce the framework, and then we'll see like three applications. So one will be about, well, actually only two. We'll see how to combine and relate different views, and then we'll talk a bit about locality and subsystems, and then I'll say some words about more applications. So the whole idea is to frame this from the perspective of a subjective agent. Okay? So then I want to be able to formalize states of knowledge of this agent. So for instance, imagine I draw this box and I say inside, there's either a sheep or a fox, and I ask you, okay, how do you formalize your knowledge of the animal that is inside this box? And, well, you only have these two things, right, to go with. You have no probability distribution over them or anything. So without loss of information, you can represent your knowledge as a set, right? It's either a sheep or a box or a fox. So in the same way, if I told you, well, there's a quantum state, either rho or sigma, and I don't tell you the probability distribution, and I tell you, okay, what is your knowledge now? There's no reason why you should assign anything like a uniform probability distribution to it. So you can represent your knowledge like this. Okay? Whereas if I give you some probability distribution, then you can do this convex combination, which is again a density matrix. Okay. So this is the main idea behind our framework. So we start with a state space, which is for an agent the most precise descriptions of reality. So I'll give a quantum example later, but just for some intuition, imagine that I want to describe some animal that I just saw, then my state space could be all the animal species that I know. So for instance, an element could be the North American beaver. And then specifications are just sets, okay, of this element. So which correspond to states of knowledge. So, for instance, if I see an animal and I only know it's a beaver, this corresponds to saying, well, it's either a North American or an Eurasian beaver. And then this specification space is just a set of all these subsets. So it's like the power set, but I will exclude the empty set. We'll see in a moment why. Okay? So this is a set ordered by inclusion. So if a set is smaller than another one, it means it's a more specific description. For instance, beaver is more specific than saying mammal, which is more specific than saying animal, which is your omega. And this is a joint semilattice. And it looks like, look at this. So it looks more or less like this. Your omega here. So these are all the possible states, or all the possible sets. And they're ordered by specificity here. So less specific, more elements up on top, and less down here. So here you have like individual states, whereas here you have like the least specific description of all, which is just omega. And for simplicity, I'll represent this as a triangle. This is just because the number of elements in each row is this combinatorial thing. Doesn't matter. OK. So just to have some quick notion of how things work here, so forgetting corresponds to going to a larger set, right? So for instance, I saw an animal which was a jaguar, and I forgot exactly what type of cat it is. So now I have a bigger set called cat with more elements. So I lost specificity going to a bigger set. And combining knowledge now is simply just intersecting sets. Okay? So if I said I saw an animal and I know it's a panthera and dotted, so it's either a leopard or a jaguar, and Marcus tells me, oh, and I know it was in Africa, so it's either a leopard or a cheetah, and you intersect our knowledge, then we know that it was a leopard. But if we intersect sets that are not compatible, so for instance, if someone else comes along and tells me, oh, it's either a lion or a tiger, we get the empty set, and the only conclusion we can reach is that someone was wrong. Okay? So we say two specifications are compatible if they are not, if they intersect. Okay. So quantum examples, more interesting. So we fix a Hilbert space, let's say a large one, say A and B. And then the space state are all the density matrices here. And specifications are just sets of density matrices. But let's see some examples that give you some intuition. So it could be any set, say rho or sigma, like if we're playing a game, and they give you one of the two. Or it could be some approximation, so all the state sets are epsilon close to rho. Or it could be something coming from the fact that I have some macroscopic observable, like energy. So it could be like an energy shell of all the states that have this energy. Or it could be some knowledge about, say, how correlated two systems are. So for instance, the specification of all the states that are product state between A and B. Or it could also be local knowledge. So if I say that I know that the marginal in a system A is rho A, what does it tell me about the global system? And what it tells me is that, well, it's one of the states that have this marginal in A. Okay? So I can represent my local knowledge at a global level with this set. And then, forgetting, going to a bigger set, you could have the example of approximations. So I sure I was wrong, but I know that there was a small perturbation, now it's only noise in this ball. Or it could be some coarse graining, going from rho at a quantum level to PVE, some macroscopic observables that are compatible with this. So this should be like the set of all states that are compatible with these values, right? That have the same pressure, or the same volume, or the same energy as rho. And it could be also taking the partial trace. So if I start knowing that the state is exactly rho AB, and then I take the partial trace, which means I forget about B, then what I have at the end is just this set of all the states that have the same marginal in A as rho did. Okay, is it clear at this stage? What? Okay, good. And just for one example of combining knowledge that I like, is taking a product state between two local states. So this is, if I have rho A tensor rho B, this means like the combination of three pieces of knowledge, that the marginal in A is rho, marginal in B is sigma, and that they are in the product state. Okay, and you can represent each of these pieces of knowledge as a specification, which is neat. Okay, so then what is a resource theory? Well, it's just a specification space with some set of operations, and I demand that they act like this, so they act on individual elements, individual states. So for instance, if I didn't know if I had rho or sigma, and now I apply this function, then this should be the same, this should be a comma here, should be the same as applying f on rho or applying f on sigma. Right? So this is the same as asking for maps to be linear so that they preserve convexity. Right? So maps preserve this notion that a set is a state of knowledge. Okay.
Are you kind of fixing a physical system there, or can these states live on a sort of Hilbert space?
So for the case of resource theories, in which I'm trying to convert states to states, they all live in the same set.
So you're fixing a Hilbert space?
In the quantum case, I would be fixing a Hilbert space, yes. But this is more general than a quantum state. Than
sure,
a quantum,
yeah.
Okay, good. So examples would be, say, all the, say, trace-preserving completely positive maps, or any subset of this. Or say, rules of a game tell me from which position in chess I can get to what position. Okay. And then constructions. I'm trying to induce this pre-order, right? So I say that a function v constructs w from a function f constructs w from v. If f of e is contained in w, then you can ask, oh, why are you asking for contained instead of equal here? And to give a silly example, if I have a function that, like evolution, transforms fish into a lizard, in particular, it transforms fish into a reptile. Okay. So the idea is that forgetting is always for free. Going to a less specific description is always for free. So if f of rho equals sigma, then in particular, I reach the state of knowledge. I can also reach the state of knowledge of being in an epsilon ball of sigma. Okay. And the pre-order is, again, just, well, I can construct w from v if there's some function that does it. One of the nice things about this is that now it's very easy to define what a free resource is. Because a free resource is something that I can always achieve, even if I don't know anything about the initial state. And not knowing anything about the initial state, this is formalized by saying I'm in omega, right? The state could be any of these omegas. Okay.
So, sorry.
Yes?
Actually, going back a slide, you had this example of rho tensor sigma as three pieces of knowledge.
Yes.
So what if you have a partially entangled state? Is that, you can certainly have the two pieces, the trace for A and the trace for B. But how do you,
you could also have a specification that is like all the states that have this much mutual information or that have this property.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could have it.
And you can,
I don't know if you'd get a unique state, but
yeah.
But you know, if you're in a state in a space ABC, then this would also not be a unique state. This would be just all the states that have the marginal rho weight and so sigma B. Yes. Any more questions at this stage? Okay. So then we are interested in relating these different pictures, right? So we have, I said that my state space is the most precise description of reality that an agent can have. But then there could be someone else saying, oh, actually, I know the world better than you do. I have a more complete description, which is sigma. How can we conciliate our two views? So this could be someone, okay, this is my S omega. This could be someone who just knows more elements of reality. For instance, I know all the animal species, but this person found a new species. So it adds one more element to omega. Or it could be someone who has a more precise knowledge of each of my elements of reality. So for instance, I know all the animal species, but this person can also distinguish them up to gender or subspecies. And we relate this via specification embeddings, which technically they are order embeddings, which are also homomorphisms. And these two special cases that I was saying, we call extensive embeddings. So in the extensive embeddings, I'm mapping states to states. Okay, my most precise are still your most precise. You just know more of them. And it's just you cannot come back, right? I have no way to describe your new species of lizard in my framework because it's just a new element of reality. In the case of intensive embeddings, where you have more precise descriptions, then I can come back. So then, you know, imagine that you have a female dog. I can still describe this in my framework as a dog. Okay. So technically, what happens is that you have a map, an embedding going there, and then a map coming back as well in the form of Galois insertion, which just means the following. Which just means that if I start here with the, in my reduce description, say dog, and I come back here, now this will be the set of male dog, female dog, and then I come back, I recover dog again, it's the identity. Yeah? So Tobias, if you want, this is similar to when you had this wiggly line, you had the measurement, and then you had a transformation coming back. This can be seen as a Galois insertion, actually. And the other way around, so say here I start with a female dog, and I go back here, it's a dog, and I come back here, now it's a female dog or a male dog. So this corresponds to some forgetting to the level of specificity that you have. Okay? And it's a function in this side. So quantum examples. Extensive quantum embeddings would be, say, go from real quantum theory to complex quantum theory, right? From considering only real density matrices to complex density matrices, or going from accepting only states on an energy shell to all the states, or from classical states to all the quantum states, okay? You just have more elements. The intensive quantum embeddings are more interesting. So for instance, you could go from density operators to macroscopic variables, PVE. Okay, so this would be like, this would be all the states that are compatible with these variables. Or from density operators to some hidden variable theory. Or, which was surprising for me in the beginning, from a subsystem to a larger space, this is also an intensive quantum embedding. So I don't know how long you want to spend in this slide, but so the idea here is that as omega is a set of density operators, and here would be the set of hidden variables. So for any set of density matrices, I'm giving you, I go to this set of all hidden variables compatible with this, and then vice versa. And then we can also do this with the subsystems, it's exactly the same, okay? So if I start, with some rho A, then I'll get here my rho A hat, so all the states that are compatible with this marginal. Yes. And whereas the function to go to the reduced state is just a partial trace. Okay. Yes?
Just a quick question. So I'm a bit unclear about the conceptual difference between the two types of embedding. So if I have an extensive embedding, can't I always create an intensive one? Just so suppose we're talking about all of the species of animals, and you discover, you know, a new three-eyed lizard or whatever. So can't I take my old space and say I had, you know, a crocodile there? I could map that to crocodile or three-eyed lizard. Right? So if I take everything and map it to the union of what it was before, the new thing, wouldn't that be intensive?
Yes, okay, you can do this. But so the idea is that the embedding itself is defining how these elements relate. And if you do this, you're kind of cheating, right? You kind of.
What I'm concerned about is how do you identify just from the structure, just from the abstract structure of the resource theory, whether there should be.
Yes. So I can show you some examples of deriving an intensive embedding. And the idea then is that then if I have like a big resource theory and a small resource theory, if I can map my functions in the reduced one to the functions in the big one in a way, like by going back and forth, we'll see this in a moment, then it makes sense to talk of it as an intensive embedding. But yes, in general, you can do this, yes. By the way, I think that this is why the fact that these embeddings are actually both intensive embeddings, I think. It just my idea also explains why the same kind of techniques can be used for cryptography and for proving that a ontology of the quantum state. Because it's always the same, like asking if there is like a bigger hidden variable theory, or asking if there is a bigger subsystem such that someone else could be correlated with what we know, like an adversary could be correlated with what you know. Okay. So now I said I wanted to combine resource theories, and here, so there's many ways in which you can combine them. So for instance, one would be just really combine them. So just take the intersection of the sets of allowed operations. So for instance, taking thermal operations and LOCC. Okay, now you have these two restrictions. Or you could have like these mother and daughter theories, which are very popular in non-locality theories, in which you have some less restrictive theories, say all the quantum maps, and then a daughter is just a restriction of this on your set of operations. And this might look trivial, but actually, this allows us somehow to, if you're doing physics, to try to study the physical reality and to try to find subsystems at a level of the mother theory. And then the other case is when now we have this, we have an embedding from some small space to a big space. And I've defined all the, I have a resource theory here, so I know how to make some function f here. And I would ask like, oh, how can I define a resource theory in the small one? Okay, and you can do this just by, I start with some state here. I go to the big one, I apply my function, and I come back. And this is like my f in the reduced state. So this is something that we can use. We could use, for instance, to relate, macroscopic thermodynamics, where you know some variables, to say thermal operations, and check if you actually get the same things. Or it could be that you need some extra coarse graining at level of the functions here to recover what thermodynamics traditionally is. So this already gives you some coarse graining. Because if you map between two states that have the same pressure, then this would be identity here, for instance. But it could be that the resource theory that we have at thermodynamics, the one traditionally used, also have some extra coarse graining at the level of functions. Okay. Or you could think like, I have two intensive embeddings, one for Alice and one for Bob. I can see what Alice can do and what Bob can do there, etc. All right. And so the last thing that I would like to talk in detail would be this finding the operational subsystems, which is an example of these reduced theories. So the idea is now is I go to the level of the mother resource theory, so the one that allows me for the most operations because there I have the most structure. And I look at subsets of operations, and I compute their commutants. So it's just everything that commutes with these operations here. So for instance, if I start with the set of all operations on the first qubit, and I have three qubits, then a commutant would give me the set of all operations in the other two. And if I take the bicommutant, which is taking the commutant again, I recover the set of all operations in the first one. And I say that, well, if this equals that, then I have a subsystem. Then I defines me a subsystem at a level of functions. So for an example of why would you do this, then let's look at, imagine that I take the set of all operations on A and the set of all operations in B, but no joint operations. Okay? Then if I take the commutant, I'll get all operations in C. Then if I take the bicommutant, so the commutant again, then I recover all the joint operations in A and B. Okay? And this is a subsystem, but this is not. It's just two systems individually. I think in the case of Von-Neumann algebras, this taking the bicommutant corresponds to taking the closure of a Von-Neumann algebra. And for finite systems in quantum theory, it's been proven that these commutation relations at a level of functions define me all the subsystems at a level of the Hilbert space. and for infinite dimensions is called Tillerson's problem. But my opinion is that the relevant thing is always starting from the set of operations, because this is what is what we can do, what we can observe. Anyway, so joint systems are taking like this, and we have an nice theorem saying that the set of all subsystems with this operation and in the intersection is a lattice. Doesn't matter. Systems are independent, obviously, if they commute. And then in the case of having a big matter theory, like quantum theory, and then taking dosers like thermal operations or LOCC, then we just inherit the subsystem structure. So now we can just characterize what a local embedding is from here. And then, well, very simply, a local embedding is one that commutes with operations in the other system. So the problem is that at this stage, I have defined subsystems at a level of operations, but not at a level of state. So I don't know what it means to have a reduced state yet. I don't know what it means to have local knowledge. And I tried to define this. So imagine that someone gives me some local embedding and asks me, well, some embedding, and asks me, is this a local embedding or not? And I can say, well, yes, if it doesn't matter what we do, say, in system B, and we still get the same embedding, then yes. So for instance, the partial trace, if I do some operation in B and then trace out B, then I still recover the same as not doing this operation. Right? Okay. And in this case, if I do this idea of starting in the big state space, going to the little one and coming back, say forgetting to the level of specificity of the reduced space, then this corresponds to forgetting a subsystem. So in quantum mechanics, this would be corresponds to taking the partial trace. And then you can say a specification is local if forgetting the rest. So is local in A, is forgetting the A commutant gives you back the same specification. Okay. So we found a way to identify local states of knowledge at the level of the big space. Of course, this only tells you, given an embedding, can it test if it does this? Can it test if it's local? But actually, we have, I will not talk about this, but you characterize some forgetting maps that induce this strong local structure and generate all the local embeddings. And we can even find some examples in which you can derive them from the set of operations. Okay. I'll not talk about this. So then what is the local resource theory? Well, the local resource theory is just in a subsystem A. We just take all the operations that define the subsystem A and then take the reduced ones, right? So if this would be FA, then I do this magic and then I have like FA small in my reduced specification space. Okay, so that is more or less the end. I could just talk about a few more things that we derived. One is that talking about approximations is very natural now, because approximations are just other specifications, just like anything else. So I can, I can define, say, rho epsilon as being just, epsilon of rho according to some distance measure. And then to talk about the cost of of creating rho up to some error epsilon, then I can just talk about the cost of going to this specification, right? So then we have easy way to characterize if some theory is stable or not. I didn't talk anything about probabilistic knowledge and convexity. This is because that's a very tricky topic, I think. So our idea is that we do not want to impose some notion of probability theory, but if my agent has already some notion of probability, and this means like he has some convex space state, state space? Yes, if you have some convex state space, then we find a way to respect this convexity and to characterize like what is a convexity preserving thing. And then everything works out, like all the local embeddings are also convex, etc. Okay. So this is the framework, and we think it's very general and very nice. And now we want to use it to explore monotones, meaning trying to derive, say, things corresponding to entropy measures, but at a level of specification. So for instance, smooth entropy measures would be just going to this smoothed specification, etc. And see what if you can get something that is more than just reproducing the results we already know. And also we want to try to apply this to very different resource series, because all the intuition we have to derive all these concepts came from like quantum resource theory, especially thermodynamics. And so we'd like to apply this to, say, an adversarial setting in cryptography or generalized probability theories, etc., and see what new notions we can come with. I forgot to say, this is joint work with Lea Kremer and Renato Renner, who are at ETH Zurich. And I thank you for your attention.
So I like this definition of subsystem that you've given. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you, for example, have looked at real quantum mechanics, where you know that the tensor product doesn't work out.
I haven't looked at this, no.
Okay, but this makes it make sense. Like if you have a very huge dimensional real Hilbert space,
mm-hmm.
just you know try this and see what the subsystem would look
like. So I could say a few more things about the tensor product. The tensor product is actually more complicated to define than just the subsystems. Because then we have to try to define what does it mean for something to be uncorrelated. And it's not just, you know, it's not just taking, what is this? So of course I could, if I know that these are local specifications, then I could do just this. Okay, but this would be like all the, say, all the quantum states that are compatible with these two marginals. And then if I want to define this specification of saying they're in a product state in a general case, it's tricky. So one of the interesting things is if you don't have functions that decouple subsystems, so say if everything is unitary, then you cannot define this in general. It makes sense, right? It has no meaning to say that you have uncorrelated specifications, if nothing destroys correlation, if nothing breaks the symmetry. But otherwise, if these functions exist, then we have a way to define this specification, and we can see if this works in real quantum mechanics or not. You can see if there's a problem there. Yep. Yes?
So about this probability question.
Mm-hmm.
So is there some sort of middle ground between having probability and not having probability? I mean, In the sense that, Bayesian approach would say that, you know, you can't know anything without assigning probabilities to it.
Yes.
The version you presented during most of the talk was, well, you kind of know these are possibilities, but there's
yes.
no relative likelihood. But in practice, it seems frequently you say, well, these are the possibilities. I don't really know exactly what the probabilities are, but this thing seems likely, this thing seems not very likely. Is there a way to capture that?
So, I can tell you what we do, which is, yeah, I see the need for this, and well, I can tell you what we manage to have right now. So, what we have is, imagine that you have some convex space, okay, like. You yourself, the agent, has some notion of probability, okay? And then how do I use this in my framework? Like how do I, give this idea? And the idea there is that if you have some, so say you have rho or sigma, then for you this is equivalent to saying that, oh, I have rho or sigma, but I don't know the probability distribution, okay, of saying like this. and I take the union of all p's because you don't know which one of them is. And this would be like some, this is actually just taking the convex hull of a specification. And this is a notion that it's like an extra structure that we impose in the specification space, saying these two things are actually equivalent.
Or you could say you look at, instead of looking at all subsets, you look at just the convex subsets.
And yes, looking at all the convex. Yes, yes. So, yeah, exactly. Looking only at convex subsets. And then you can find a way to define that is still consistent of defining mixtures of convex specifications, and then saying what it is to preserve this convexity, etc. Yeah. It's not the same as doing something Bayesian on top of.
Right. Well, I don't want to go whole hog in the Bayesian direction.
Okay.
The Bayesian insistence on having fire is kind
yeah.
of annoying sometimes.
Yeah, I wouldn't know.
So
yes.
I don't quite see it how that setup captures the kinds of things one is typically interested in resource theories, like catalysis or rates of conversion.
Oh, yes, so you can do all this. So before I had my previous attempt of doing this talk at all these currencies and stuff, defining at the end, and I decided to put them in the beginning to motivate. But you can still define these currencies. So, you know, I can have some resource A, and I can say if it's local on A or not, right?
What is A?
A is a subsystem.
Okay.
The resource is C, so this would be my 2B coin. And I can ask, is there a way to define many copies of this resource? And there is, and one way to do this is if I can identify swap functions.
So the thing is that I don't quite see what you mean by copies, by considering
yes.
copies of the resource.
Yes, so this is what I'll do.
Okay.
So, okay. So we say that, I don't know. How do I define this? So we say that a function swaps, or a pair of functions swap to subsystems, okay? If, so swap. If for every function in the subsystem A, then swapping, there is a function in subsystem A prime.
So in order to talk about having n copies, you need to have n subsystems. Is that right?
Yes. So for now, I only have one two. Okay.
Yeah.
So I can ask if my theory has this swapping things. So for instance, in LOCC, you could swap between two subsystems in Alice's side, but you cannot swap between Alice and Bob.
Yeah.
Okay. So then, given if I have this, then if I have some local resource in A, then I can swap it. Okay, and this gives me some resource in some copy of this in A prime. Okay, and then I can take the intersection of the two. And this would be, so then if I do this, this could be two copies of the resource. And then I can ask that there are two independent copies if I also intersect it with this state of knowledge, if I could define it. But I think more generally, this depends on the theory. So if you have, say, quantum states and your currency is a pure state, then if you have two of them, they have to be independent anyway. So in a more general setting, I don't know if it always makes sense to demand that they are uncorrelated or not. We'd have to try. But so now that I have a way of defining copies, right?
Yeah.
Then I have a way of defining what a currency is in exactly the same sense. And So then I can say, I can say, I have some resource which has support in some A, meaning it's local in A, and now I have some wallet, which is like many copies of my thing in some system B, and now I want to, I can transform all of this to some other specification, W.
So the main, or kind of what you need to have in any case in order to talk about all these things is you need to have an arbitrary number of subsystems.
No, not necessarily.
Or just talk about an arbitrary number of copies.
Not necessarily. So to do asymptotic conversion rates, sure.
Yeah.
Yes, there, sure.
And
but in general, it could be that they have a finite resource series such that there is some resource such that there's some limited number of copies that allows me to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, if I, maybe not in quantum theory, but if you're thinking of a game, like there could be, I don't know, some position that always wins or something similar to this. I don't know yet. Yes. And in general, I'm not very interested in asymptotic conversion rates, to be honest. I'm more interested in the single shot case. But yes.
Yes? If there are no other questions, then thank Lydia again.
Thank you.